You just clicked on a gun violence podcast. There will be mentions of gun violence and self-harm, including lethal self-harm, so just want to let you know that beforehand. Nothing graphic or anything, but I thought you should know first. Hello, and welcome to the Honest Politics Podcast. My name is Alex Gamsik, and I am the founder of Honest Politics, LLC. My company does high-level political consulting, but not for politicians. My services are catered to everyday Americans just like you and me. So let's get started. And first off, I wanted to make an announcement that, as I showed on my social medias, there is not going to be a podcast every week, or at least I'm not committing to it, especially not Thursdays at 4 p.m. I've gotten to a point where it's too labor-intensive to make and produce this podcast all on my own. I've considered taking a hiatus, I've considered making it monthly, but it's just too hard to make a commitment. So instead, I'm going to be releasing them when I feel like it. It's probably going to be about once a month, hopefully more. If you want episodes more often, or you want one tailored specifically to a topic that you desire, you can pay me for the cost of the episode. I will say it's probably going to be about $33, and I'll put out whatever episode you want at whatever time frame you want, as long as it's reasonable and doesn't interfere with my own job. Second, if you want to be a interview guest, that is for free, and that can happen anytime over the Anchor app, which is also free, or in person, just let me know. And I'm extremely excited to have your voice on the podcast. Just send me a message through any of the social media accounts. You can find it by searching Honest Politics LLC. All right, let's start the new show. This gun violence podcast was inspired by something I heard on the radio. They were saying that in self-defense, guns are used 2 million times per year. And I was very surprised by that statistic, especially considering no one that I know has ever used guns in self-defense. So how does it happen 2 million times every year in just the United States? I started wondering, as all public policy majors do, where did that number come from? And then, so I went to my academic research and found that a study by Kleck and Gertz, who are two reputable social scientists from the University of Florida, which is also reputable, came up with this in 1995. They used surveys to ask people how often they used guns in self-defense. And what they came up with was an estimate based on probabilities, of course, and statistics, because they didn't interview 300 million people. They interviewed a sample and extrapolated from there. But on the low end, they found 2.5 million gun self-defense uses every year. If you are a pro-gun person, you take this study to heart and use it as self-defense, especially because this study could be replicated fairly easily, and when it was retried by others, it bore the same results. And obviously in science, if you have an experiment that can be reproduced easily, then it's much more reputable than, say, something that can't be reproduced easily. Let's continue with the pro-gun side. Guns are seen as the best deterrent, I guess, for people invading your home, because if someone is coming in with a gun, you're not going to be able to defend yourself with a knife or a baseball bat if someone just shoots you. And you want to have the best gun possible, because there exist assault weapons in the United States that have 30-round clips that can shoot like boom, 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 basically that fast, even if they're not fully automatic, which is actually illegal here. But these semi-automatic can shoot pretty fast. It can have 30 or even 100 rounds in a drum, and they fire very accurately and with low recoil, meaning that it's much easier to get off a lot of accurate shots. And if you, say, have a pistol that's limited to 6 rounds, no scopes or nothing, it's going to be tougher for you to defend yourself from someone like that, or even a group of intruders. Now, I've done a little bit of research on what the gun enthusiasts say is best for self-defense, and they say there is no such thing as too few guns. They want you to buy more guns. And they think that the more guns you own, the more varied variety, the more you'll have for any type of situation. I've even seen a YouTube video where this one man was promoting a gun that could be held in one hand because you'd be using your other hand to hold back your wife and children, I guess, who will be cowering behind you as you defend your home. And let's talk a little more about guns. I know that there's a lot of terminology. They're complex machines, especially when you get into all the differences. You have the fully automatic, which are banned in the United States. Rocket-propelled grenades, also banned in the United States. You have shotguns, which are better for close range. They have a wide spread in their shot. So, like, little pellet kind of things are going to scatter everywhere. You have pistols, which are usually much smaller and portable, so they can be grabbed from a drawer or hidden under a bed in like a little holster or something. And you can conceal carry those pretty easily. You have the assault weapons, which I talked about, which are usually bigger, but they can have a bunch of attachments, and they're usually an all-around great weapon to use in terms of range, accuracy, recoil, and rate of fire. Of course you have sniper rifles and bolt action, which you wouldn't want to use for self-defense. Those are more for hunting. There's also an invention called rifling, and that is when, you know, in colonial times, you just had a musket ball that went into a musket, and you carry this huge heavy thing, and it takes you like a whole minute to load one round and fire it. If you were really good in colonial times, you could fire once every 30 seconds. But these things were also just so inaccurate. That's why people stood in a line. You know, they all line up together and fire at once. That's because it was so inaccurate that you had to fire all at once in a line, because it would create like a wall of bullets hurling towards the people on the other side, because they were so inaccurate. It's not like in the movies where you shoot and like someone 100 yards away will collapse. No, these, you could be aiming correctly and the bullet will miss the guy by like 20 feet. So
this is Alex coming in from the editing phase of this podcast. These are not bullets, these are balls. There's a difference, as I'm going to go into right now.
These are terrible. But rifling was when the ball turned into more of a bullet shape, and the inside of the barrel was grooved in a spiral. You know how when quarterbacks will throw a football, they throw it in a spiral, and it, because it has that pointed tip shape, it kind of slices through the air in a rotating motion. If you're an anime fan, you know the Rasengan, the rotation makes it stronger. But anyway, the rotation makes it much more accurate. So rifles, and this happened around the Civil War time, you know, 1860s, made rifles much more deadly. You keep going on, you get automatic weapons. But warfare has dramatically changed since colonial times. Some of the anti-gun advocates will say, look, when the founders said that you could own a gun in the Second Amendment, they weren't necessarily thinking that you could kill 30 people in 30 seconds with this gigantic weapon that just anyone would be allowed to use. So let's get back to the academic studies. And all the other academic studies and the reputable sources I found were a little questionable about the Kleck and Gertz study. They found a lot of false positives. And I'm going to go through them one by one. It might seem a little clunky, but again, I'm not putting a ton of time into this podcast. What I'm doing is putting this out because I did some of the research already. If you want a more concise, a more well-documented episode, or you just want a report for yourself, send a message to Alex at honestpoliticsllc.com. Again, that's Alex at honestpoliticsllc.com. Send me an email. You can hire me. Your first hour is always free, but you can hire me. And we will go through this together so that you have a firm grasp on what academics have to say about gun policy.
And now for a quick advertisement.
The Harvard School of Public Health found that self-defense in gun use is overestimated, Similar to how rare diseases are overestimated in frequency. You know, you hear about like flesh-eating bacteria and all these weird diseases, and you might think it has a chance of affecting you, even though statistically it's almost never going to happen. Same with self-defense gun use. Most self-defense gun use are actually used in escalating arguments, so they're between people who already know each other and are just mad at each other. And guns are used more for intimidation than they are for self-defense. They're more used with intimates like a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, or wife than to defend a home. And other weapons are used more often to defend yourself in a home than guns ever are. And then there was a study done of people that were shot in a jail in the District of Columbia. They found that virtually none of them were wounded by law-abiding citizens. Most were shot when they were the victims of robberies, assaults, and crossfire. I apologize for the vocal fry. I realized, there's a Stuff You Should Know episode about vocal fry. And it's kind of funny because they went through the whole episode talking about it and how bad it was. They never described what it was in the beginning, but now that I know what vocal fry is, I hear it all the time and it's so annoying. Some more statistics. Victims use guns in less than 1% of contact crimes. And of 300 women who were surveyed, zero used one in self-defense against sexual assault. Victims using a gun are no less likely to be injured than others using different protective action, such as pepper spray or using another weapon or something like that. Another study found that self-defense gun use is more common among males in rural areas and away from home against male offenders who had a gun as well. After any protective action, whether it's a gun or otherwise, about 4.2% of victims are injured. If you're using a gun, there's a 4.1% of victims who are injured. So using a gun only decreases your likelihood of being safe by 0.1%. And statistically, that's basically nothing. If we look at this other study, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, found 1.3 million crimes were committed each year with a gun. And it would be kind of crazy if two times as many self-defense gun uses were used than the actual number of crimes committed every year with a gun. They called this a mythical number that usually involves research flaws, but since the Kleck and Gertz study was actually very well conducted, they thought it was the method itself intrinsically might have been wrong. So in follow-up studies, they asked if they wounded the assailants. So like they asked if, oh, you defended yourself with a gun, right? Did you hurt the person that you were defending yourself from? Apparently 132,000 perpetrators were wounded or killed using this methodology. And that number is the same number of people killed or received in emergency rooms for gun treatment. Even though most of the gun treatment hospitalizations or deaths are from suicides, accidents, and criminal assault, it doesn't make sense that the same number of people who are apparently shot are the same number going to the ER for any kind of gunshot wound. It just, the two numbers don't add up. It doesn't make sense. There was also extrapolation that 332,000 say it was used to stop rapists, but that's actually more than the total number of rapes and attempted rapes combined in the United States. So those two numbers don't equate either, using just common sense. And as of 1997, 40% of American households had a gun, with 14 million people routinely carrying one, which shows that guns are just very ingrained in many people's lives. A more accurate estimate based on if someone was a victim and had direct contact with a perpetrator, if you take and downgrade it, it shows that from 1992 to 1994, there's about 108,000 gun self-defense uses annually, which is much less than the 2.5 million, but I still think that is a large number. And if you're a gun rights advocate, you might say, well, yeah, that's 108,000 people that might have saved their own life using a gun, and wouldn't that make it worth it? There's a political article that talked about social desirability bias, wherein you want to be the hero who defended yourself with a gun, and therefore you're more likely to think that it's true
that you did defend yourself using a gun. Say someone walks in your house accidentally and you have a gun brandished and they run away. You weren't really defending yourself with a gun. You just, like, mistook the situation. Or if you hear some rustling outside, you say, go away, and you have your gun. And whatever it is runs away, but it might have been an animal or something, you know. People can be fooled into thinking that something happened, even if it really didn't. And there's also gun owners responding strategically to surveys, wherein the NRA members know that these surveys are being conducted, and they might say that they defended themselves with a gun even when they really didn't, just to kind of boost the numbers on these surveys. And there's telescoping, which means you're remembering a self-defense incident outside the range of the question. So if a researcher says, have you used this in the last 12 months? You might be remembering an incident from 14 months ago and saying, yeah, I defended myself with a gun at this point. But anyway, I'm about to move on to a gigantic study, basically. And this guy used 85 plus citations, which is crazy for an academic article. This guy did a ton of research. But he did have occasional grammar mistakes. I think this is because he's some guy who has two PhDs at European universities. He's a German social psychologist, meaning that he might have been making mistakes because he's from a different country and doesn't speak English as his first language. Still, for a peer-reviewed article, it seemed kind of silly. Anyway, I am going to go through the study because there are some things that I think are worth mentioning. At the time of this study, there were 270 to 310 million guns in the United States, which is almost as much as people. By now, it's more than people. The United States is by far the most armed people in the world, but the U.S. homicide rate is higher than most European countries. It is true that many countries have higher homicide rates and lower gun ownership rates, like Honduras. And it's also true that many countries have low homicide rates and fewer guns. In the U.S., homicide is, it doesn't correlate with gun ownership. Whether the gun ownership goes up, crime goes up, none of that plays out. He goes into what causes homicide. It includes resource deprivation, meaning you don't have much stuff, racial heterogeneity, social disintegration, and percentage of young people in a population. He talked about how in Europe there is no right to own a gun. You have to have a license with a legitimate reason in order to have a gun, like hunting, or you're a particularly high risk for self-defense. All public places are a gun-free zone in Europe, basically. You just can't carry guns around like you can in the United States. They looked at studies, and some of these studies, I'm not going to go into specifics, but they found that just holding a toy gun or seeing a gun in a room increased testosterone levels in men and made them more aggressive, or made people feel more irritated just by having a gun around. So it does lead to more aggressive, it does prime aggressive behaviors. Berkowitz and LePage studied it and called it the weapon effect. And when you're angered by one study participant, you're more likely to react aggressively if there's also a gun present. And this study has been replicated. So he kind of is showing that guns themselves intrinsically might increase homicidal behaviors like aggression. A gun is 7 times more likely to result in killing than other personal weapons if you're attacking somebody. And by increasing the chance of an end state in which death occurs, it increases that probability that such an intention is adopted. So you're more likely to go attack someone with the intent to kill because you're more certain that you can kill them with a gun rather than, say, a baseball bat, which might not actually kill somebody. Guns are used in 4% of crimes and 20% of violent crimes, but they're responsible for 70% of all killings, which just shows the lethality of them compared to other weapons. There was a Kleck and Hogan study, which compared the rate of gun ownership to a sample of 13,000 inmates who had committed homicide compared to a random sample. And after controlling for a ton of factors, they found a 36% higher likelihood that a person committed criminal homicide if you owned a gun. In 8 studies that he looked at, 7 found a positive association between gun ownership and homicide. So there was a question of reverse causality or a third variable. More guns because there's more homicides. Like, if you live in a dangerous area, you're going to want to arm yourself. So maybe owning a gun is a result of high crime areas. So he looked at this. And the third variable is saying that, like, maybe there's an X factor that leads to more homicides and more guns, like higher drug use or something. I don't know. However, the third variable is not likely because it would affect non-gun homicides and gun homicides at the same rate. But guns and homicides, basically, it's gun homicides and guns, not all homicides and guns, that are correlated in these ways. Hard to say reverse causality because there's an increase in gun sales after a massacre. One of these follow-up studies that show how many people use guns in self-defense only had 19 respondents claiming they used a gun in self-defense. So even just a few false positives could change the outcome number in a huge way. In the United States between 1980 and 2008, 60% of homicides were committed by someone who knew the perpetrator, and only 20% were stranger homicides. So another study from 1993 found that individuals with a firearm were nearly 3 times more likely to be murdered than individuals in a home with no gun. Most of these killings are during a quarrel, often where alcohol was involved, and previous periods of violence had occurred in the household. Only half of murders were committed by homicides, but only these homicides were increased by gun ownership. 5 similar studies were published since then with the same results. Another study found that household or personal gun ownership meant you were 2 times as likely to be murdered. Nearly a third of homicides were during a family argument. Household gun ownership increased homicide risk only for those living with others but not alone. It basically keeps going on like this. Heavy drinkers are more likely to apply for concealed weapon license. If you're more racist, you're more likely to have a gun in the home. There are nearly twice as many gun-related suicides as there are homicides. That means in 2011, there were 11,000 homicides and 20,000 suicides using a gun. The odds of committing suicide are much higher in a house where there is a gun, but it's not a substitute for other means. Overall, suicide, and not just gun suicide, increase when there's a gun in the home. 1/3 to 4/5 of suicide attempts are impulsive, and most people never try it again. More than 90% who do not go on... More than 90% of people who try to kill themselves do not actually die from it. But 90% of attempts with guns are effective. 3% of people who use drugs or cutting are effective. Guns are much more lethal, in addition to making it more likely you're going to commit suicide, trying to commit suicide. I know Australia is an example that people like to use when they're defending anti-gun policies. After the Port Arthur massacre in Australia in 1996, there was a ban on certain weapons and a huge buyback program. 650,000 guns were destroyed, and Australia's stockpile was reduced by 1/5. This led to a reduction in firearm suicides by 80%. With no effect on non-firearm suicides, which might have been just the serious of what they witnessed and their dedication not to pride the weapons over people's lives, you know. Unintentional firearm injuries are about 73,000 in the United States, with about 700 deaths per year. These injuries are strongly associated with firearm availability. So accidents are a huge thing. Like, if you go into YouTube and search gun fails, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about.
For all this talk about responsible gun owners, even just 5% of people who might own a gun and not be responsible leads to tons of accidents or killings. Mass shootings only account for 547 deaths in the last 3 decades, but they increase in frequency. They've tripled since 2011. I think this study was released in 2016. Active shooter situations are defined... as defined by the FBI, have also increased. Government efforts to stop gun research include having no registration system. So 300 million guns are unaccounted for in the United States. background checks will not apply to all these weapons that are already in existence, even if they did go into effect. In DC versus Heller, the court case, it granted everyone the right under the Second Amendment to own a gun, but it didn't give unlimited rights, which the author here argues would allow gun licensing. More than 40% of illegal guns are made through what are called straw purchases, meaning you buy it and give it to somebody else. And so that means if you have a, even if you pass a background check, you can just hand the gun off to somebody else who might not pass it, which is why this author argues that gun licensing would be much more effective than gun background checks. The majority of Americans support basic gun measures, but Congress doesn't listen, mostly because of NRA lobbying and campaigning, much like the tobacco industry used to campaign, using campaign contributions and framing the issue in terms of liberty. So what we really need, according to the author, is a culture shift. The way to shift the culture is with a campaign of public information, similar to how tobacco use declined from public information campaigns. Three big points to use. Gun owners have a higher risk of being murdered and even higher risk of suicide. Owning guns endangers the lives of others in the household. And there were 11,000 criminal homicides with guns in 2011, with 47,000 injuries. The risk of being a victim of accidental shooting is higher when guns are around. So you frame it as a health issue and as a negative externality, just like smoking is. And the smoking rates dropped from 42.5% to 18.1%. So maybe the same thing can happen with guns. Smoking used to be cool, but now it's a sign of shame and weakness. Maybe guns one day can be a sign of shame and weakness as well. So that's the research I did, both for the pro-gun side and the anti-gun side, looking, you know, through my research previously, the academic research I've done now, and just a little bit of extra knowledge that I've had on firearms and using them in self-defense. I'm not going to give an opinion either way. I just laid out both cases, I think. And like I said, the podcast could have been better. I could have put a whole narrative together. Mostly I was just reading. I was reading notes. I was not reading a script. If you know the difference, you know, basically, if I had gone and done this the right way, I would have taken all the notes and written a whole paper on it and then read the paper out loud. But I'm not doing that without sponsorship. If you want a really good episode on whatever topic you talk about, you want me to focus on one side of the argument, just send a message in an email to alex@honestpoliticsllc.com. And my throat is tired from talking, so I'm going to get going. It was great having you listen to this podcast. Hope you have a great rest of the day. And I will see you next week as we seek to discover more of the stories behind the statistics. Hope you have a great rest of the day as we keep to... And I will see you next week as we seek to discover more of the stories behind the statistics.